Cassette 5, Side 2. The ambassador told Farmer,
"Yes, we too are going to help with the Haitians."
Polite and worthless promises, maybe, but Farmer, in the role of supplicant, seemed artfully ingenuous. Assume that each new promise was real, and obtain as many as possible, to increase the odds that one or two might be real. And he'd follow up with calls, letters, emails, and if those didn't bring results, they still might produce a little shame, which might increase the chances that the next promise would be real. Farmer also had formal duties in Cuba. He was scheduled to give two talks at the conference.
"What are the subjects?" I asked.
"One speech is for clinicians. How to deal with HIV and TB co-infection," he said. "The other is why life sucks." He began the second speech by saying, "Today I'm going to talk about the problem of a more important co-infection, which is poverty. Poverty and inequality." Up on the screen in the amphitheater of Cuba's infectious disease hospital, beside the tall, reedy fellow in the black suit, the blue waters of the Peligue Reservoir appeared. "Now in this country where I have worked for 18 years, the campesinos lost their land to a hydroelectric dam." Farmer asked the audience to remember the days when expert opinion had retailed all sorts of nonsense about who caught HIV and why. The days when to be Haitian was to be part of a risk group. He and his staff had designed a study in Cange, he said, to try to get at the local facts. 200 women were involved, half infected with HIV, half not. Almost none in either group had been exposed to risks often mentioned in expert commentary: intramuscular injections, blood transfusions, intravenous drug use. Around Cange, Farmer noted, the peasants' vocabulary didn't even contain a word for illicit drugs, which virtually no one there could afford anyway, and none of the women had been especially promiscuous. On average, they'd had sexual relations with two different men, consecutively, not concurrently, practicing serial monogamy. Between the groups of women, only two differences stood out. Unlike the uninfected, many of the ones with AIDS had worked as servants in Port-au-Prince. Obviously, domestic service hadn't given them HIV, but it did describe their economic desperation. Working for Haiti's elite was rarely pleasant or remunerative. Uniformly, the infected women named that kind of desperation, deep poverty, and illiteracy as their reason for having taken what appeared to be the real risk for AIDS, which was cohabiting with truck drivers or soldiers. "Why those two groups of men?" Farmer asked from the podium. "Were they known to be sexier than other Haitian men?" "Of course not. What they had were steady jobs in an economy where an official unemployment rate of 70% probably understated the case. Truck drivers were mobile and could keep women in many ports, and soldiers, back in those days of military rule, had wielded a special coercive power over every peasant." Up at the podium, Farmer went on with the story. After the study was done, he returned to the United States and logged on to Medline. He entered AIDS, and the names of thousands of studies came up on his computer screen. Then he entered AIDS and women, and only a handful of studies appeared. And when I crossed AIDS, women, and poverty, the message said, "There are no studies meeting those specifications." Farmer extended a hand toward the screen behind him, now filled with a gigantically enlarged graph of the study from Cange. "There are reasons why people are uncomfortable talking about this. Fine. But if we want to stop AIDS, we better find out about this. Countries with the steepest grades of inequality and the greatest poverty have the biggest AIDS problems. And I'm sure Professor Montagnier would agree that while co-infections are important cofactors, they're not as important as these. We need to erase social inequalities, and very few countries have done that." He closed in one of his favorite ways by quoting a peasant. "A woman in Cange said to me, 'You want to stop HIV in women? Give them jobs.'" By now, I felt I was getting a sense of how Farmer put together experience and philosophy. In trying to control TB and AIDS in the Central Plateau, he had ended up wrangling not much with Third World myths, like beliefs in sorcery, but usually with First World ones, like expert theories that exaggerated the power poor women had to protect themselves from AIDS. This was Cuba, of course, the hemisphere's small, lonely iconoclast. The amphitheater, about half full, gave him a long, loud round of applause. Farmer told me he'd like to hang out at the conference, but he spent less time there than in our hotel room, lying on his bed, a pillow behind his head, a pillow under his knees, his computer on his lap. Once in a while he'd begin to doze, then jump up and pace the floor, swinging his arms, saying to himself, "Come on, pal, come on." He typed away. At the proposal for UNAIDS, at a different grant proposal for obtaining antiretroviral medicines for Zomi La Santé. You could never seek out too many sources of funding when you didn't have funding. At a counter-editorial he'd been asked to write in response to an editorial questioning the wisdom of treating MDR-TB in Russia. "Who's it for?" I asked. "The Journal of Tuberculosis and Lung Disease," he said, typing away. "I'm sure you get it at home." From time to time, he worked on his new book, Pathologies of Power. He had a bound typescript of the rough draft. It contained a chapter comparing the two ways in which AIDS had been managed on the island of Cuba, the Cuban approach and the American quarantine of HIV-positive Haitian refugees conducted in the early 90s on the Guantanamo Naval Base. In the room, Farmer read aloud from a book by a respected American political scientist who had also compared the two quarantines, calling them roughly equivalent. "It makes my blood boil," said Farmer. He didn't approve of quarantine for AIDS. "Quarantine has never been shown to be an effective measure in controlling sexually transmitted diseases," he said. He went on, "Both Guantanamo and Cuba's AIDS sanatorium were quarantines, but it's a lie to say they weren't different." He had interviewed some of the Haitians quarantined on Guantanamo, and from them heard stories of wretched treatment at the hands of the U.S. military, of food with maggots in it, of compulsory blood tests and compulsory injections of the long-acting contraceptive Depo-Provera. Its effects can last up to 18 months, of beatings when they protested. One didn't have to take the Haitians' word for all of this. In 1993, an American federal judge had described the quarantine in harsh terms and ended it, ruling it unconstitutional. The other quarantine of HIV patients in Cuba, the Cuban government's, had been conducted in a place called Santiago de Las Vegas. It lay about an hour's drive from Havana. Dr. Perez had played a big part in its history. He took us there in his battered Russian Lada sedan. I enjoyed looking out at the countryside, all colored for me by contrast with Haiti's, the electric power wires, the irrigated fields. We turned off the highway onto a narrower paved road, and after a while Dr. Perez announced, "We are arriving now to the concentration camp. You will see the concentration camp we have here." That was what the AIDS sanatorium had been called in a New York Times op-ed. On the right lay the grounds of what had clearly been a grand estate. We turned down the drive. A bare-chested, heavily muscled young man wearing a black beret was coming out the gate on a bicycle. "Please stop," said Farmer to Perez's driver. Then Farmer jumped out and called to the bicyclist, "Eduardo!" And Eduardo did a double-take, climbed off his bike, grinning, then enveloped Farmer in a hug. He was a former Cuban soldier who had contracted AIDS in Africa, a patient of Perez's. Farmer had met Eduardo on a previous trip and had doctored him a little. I never heard Farmer complain of having too many patients, and it seemed clear that he couldn't feel comfortable anywhere not having any at all. So in Cuba, he borrowed some from Perez. Farmer climbed back in, and we drove on, up to an old hacienda. A wealthy Cuban had owned it and fled during the revolution. The interior was high-ceilinged, many-roomed. Stains darkened the walls here and there, but the place wasn't exactly shabby. It had the feeling of a defrocked place, where you'd find a gray filing cabinet in a spot designed for a mahogany highboy. During lunch in the headquarters building, Dr. Perez told us his version of the history of the sanatorium. He said that he and his boss, Gustavo Curi, were giving Fidel Castro a report about malaria in Africa when Castro asked, "What are you going to do to stop AIDS from entering Cuba?" Perez went on, "Gustavo said, 'AIDS has no importance.' Then Fidel tugged his beard and said, 'You don't know what you're talking about. It's going to be the disease of the century, and it is your responsibility, Gustavo, to stop AIDS from spreading in Cuba.'" The Cuban authorities had decided to quarantine people infected with HIV at this old hacienda under military discipline. First soldiers, and then a combustible mixture of soldiers and homosexual men, nastiest, no doubt, for the gay inmates, although everyone was well-fed and got medical treatment. When Perez took over a few years later, he let in visitors, had the tall surrounding wall torn down, because reporters came here and they were climbing trees, and little by little changed the rules, first allowing patients to leave on passes once they'd shown they could be trusted to practice safe sex, and eventually lifting the quarantine altogether. Perez said he'd imagined that all the patients would leave at that point, but only 20% did, in part because conditions at the sanatorium were generally better than elsewhere. Dr. Perez led us on a tour of the patients' quarters, little houses and apartments set among gardens and palm trees. The settlement looked like a working-class American suburb. We visited the patient Eduardo's house, three little rooms. On the bureau stood a snapshot of Farmer. Paul spotted it and stared, his face turning red. When he recovered, he said to Eduardo, "I see you're still smoking cigarettes." Eduardo offered him the pack, and Farmer pushed it aside, laughing. "No. I was about to say you should quit." The tour resumed. Farmer kept remarking on how pleasant and peaceful these quarters were, and finally I said to him, "I find them kind of depressing." "Really?" He seemed surprised. "Compared to what I grew up in, it's pretty nice. They have gas stoves, air conditioning, electricity, TV." Actually, it wasn't the sanatorium's housing that troubled me. I felt that Farmer was suspending his usually sharp critical judgment. I thought he was looking only for things to praise. So I was doing the opposite. Maybe I just wanted an argument. He didn't, clearly. He let the subject drop. As we walked around, I told myself it was too easy to pass judgment now on the way various societies had responded to AIDS in the first panicky years of a terrifying public health emergency. And it was probably facile to compare the responses of the United States and Cuba. The countries were so different in size and complexity. But I had to wonder if I would have felt the same reserve if the outcomes had been reversed. By 2000, the overall rates of HIV infection and deaths from AIDS were dropping in the United States. But infections and deaths had claimed a much larger percentage of the population than in Cuba, and HIV had become mainly a heterosexual disease concentrated among the American poor. Cuba, meanwhile, had the lowest per capita incidence of HIV in the Western Hemisphere. Its HIV statistics were probably among the most accurate in the world, for the simple reason that, in Cuba, testing wasn't optional, and millions had been tested. On an island of 11 million, only 2,669 had tested positive as of 2000. The virus had progressed to AIDS in 1,003 of those people, and 653 had died. Only 5 children had caught HIV from their mothers, and all those children were still alive. Because Cuba had acted quickly to clean up its blood supply, only 10 people had contracted HIV from transfusions. One could argue that the U.S. embargo had protected the island, but then again, back at the start of the epidemic, Cuba had engaged in a lot of commerce with Africa. We drove back toward Havana. Perez said he'd gotten a call that morning from the Barbados embassy. They wanted him to see the daughter of the ambassador. "But I don't even know who she is. They phoned me 5 times yesterday. Anyway, I am with Paul Farmer today." Farmer and Perez seemed to share one favorite recreation, which was visiting patients. When Perez came to Boston, he liked to go on rounds with Farmer. Not long after we'd arrived in Havana, Farmer had asked, "Are we going to see some patients, Jorge?" "Well, of course." Perez also took him to meet Cuba's chief forensic pathologist, the person who had led the team that had found Che Guevara's secret grave in Bolivia, or claimed to have found it, some would say. The pathologist stood up at his desk to tell the story, in a loud voice, at moments practically declaiming, recounting how they had done mathematical modeling, employing their own Cuban archaeologist, soil chemist, geologist, and botanist, and how, after searching for 300 days, they had finally come upon the bones and identified them and sneaked them back to Cuba. "We were finding heroes. I was finding my heroes. As a researcher, as a scientist, and because of the revolution, we were proud. It is very important for the revolution. It is a mixture. That and doing your job." We went to dinner at Perez's house, which was about as large and well-furnished as a unit in a decent American housing development. Farmer made sure I noticed that Perez's driver ate with the family. Another night, we had dinner in a restaurant, said to have been one of Hemingway's favorites. There were probably almost as many of those in Havana as in Key West. Men with guitars surrounding the table to sing El Comandante, the mournful ballad of Che. At the hotel, Farmer got to do variations of hortatorture. There were some cockatoos in a cage in the lobby. Going in and coming out, he always stopped to gaze at them. They're psittaciforms, by the way. I know that because they're associated with a disease called psittacosis. The hotel also had a fish tank and several small fish ponds over which he'd bend his lanky torso, naming species. Blue gourami, black molly, neon tetra, orange barb. Cuba really was a holiday by his standards. In almost every other place where he worked, in Siberia, in the central plateau of Haiti, in the northern slums of Lima, in Chiapas under siege, he could send and receive email. But in Cuba, because of the embargo, he was cut off from his usual electronic routine. He'd pay for this later, but for the moment, he was relieved of the requests and duties that email brought him every day, anywhere else but in Cuba. He had traveled more than anyone I knew and seen fewer of the brochure sites. He'd never been to Machu Picchu in Peru. He'd never gone to the Bolshoi in Moscow. He didn't go sightseeing in Cuba either. On this trip, most of what he saw of old Havana, he glimpsed through the windows of Dr. Perez's Lada. A city like a tarnished heirloom, pleasing, from the outside looking in at least, in the half-decay of its sculpted cornices, arcades, and porticos, and loveliest in the warm, windy evenings when the waves crashed against the seawall, raining spray on lovers along the Malecón. But it was as if Farmer had built himself an alarm system by which every pleasant thing set off a recording saying, "You're forgetting Haiti." He stared out at the monumental banyan trees along a route that Perez's driver took and said softly, "I've worked 18 years in Haiti, and everything has gotten worse." "We haven't done enough yet in Haiti," he told me at one point. "What about Zombie La Santé?" "Zombie La Santé is an oasis, the best thing of its kind in Haiti. But it's not as good as here. The Cubans would have done a better job." Again and again during our stop in Cuba, Farmer had marveled at the attentions lavished on him. Dr. Perez had a hospital and a conference to run, and he had to entertain a surefire Nobel Prize winner-to-be in Luc Montagnier, and yet he'd spent a large part of every day and all his evenings with Farmer. One night in the hotel room, Farmer looked up from his computer and asked me what I thought accounted for this. It seemed to me that he rarely asked a question for which he didn't have the answer. So, to keep the peace, I should have tried to find the one he had in mind. Instead, I told Farmer I imagined that the Cubans liked his published attacks on American policy in Latin America, his frank admiration of Cuban public health and medicine, his efforts to create connections between Harvard and Cuba. I added, "And Jorge constantly introduces you by saying, 'He is my friend.'" I looked over and found Farmer's pale blue eyes fixed on me. The farmer's stare. It could make you think he was examining an X-ray of your soul, or, if you were irritated with him, that he imagined he was examining one. My eyes wanted to look away, and I wasn't going to let them. "I get the same reception everywhere," he said. "I'm stupefied by the way the Russians receive me, and I hate their wacky system. Why is it the same across all these radically different settings? I think it's because of Haiti. I think it's because I serve the poor. Love, ID." I had the impression he was angry, disappointed, and a little hurt. A potent combination. And then he went back to work, and I lay in bed trying to read. And in a little while he said, "What you thinking over there?" And I felt I was forgiven. And though I wasn't sure for what, this was a relief. It didn't last. When we got to the airport and learned our flight back to Miami was delayed 5 hours, we went to a little restaurant on the premises, and Farmer settled in, opening his computer. He called in Spanish to the waitress behind the counter. "Dear lady?" She had her back to us. Without turning, she replied, "Dígame, mi amor." "Speak to me, my love." Farmer laughed. He said to me, "You have to love a country where people do that." The flight delay hadn't fazed him. In fact, I was thinking, he was apt to be most cheerful when facing adversities, small ones anyway. Then, all of a sudden, he said to me, "If you're going to write about Che, it should be your own opinion, not mine." "Why is that?" I asked. "You now know more about his exhumation than 99% of Americans, and also how the Cubans feel about him. The man who dug him up was practically in tears." He was giving me the stare. "I may be sentimental," he went on, "but I'm not a goofball. I'm a hard-bitten, clinic-building, MDR-treating mother." Then it seemed he got to the heart of the matter, what I was going to write about Cuba, especially about him in Cuba. When others write about people who live on the edge, who challenge their comfortable lives, and it has happened to me, they usually do it in a way that allows a reader a way out. You could render generosity into pathology, commitment into obsession. That's all in the repertory of someone who wants to put the reader at ease rather than conveying the truth in a compelling manner. I want people to feel unhappy about Lazarus and all the others who are shafted. Otherwise, why would I have you with me? I don't have a lot at stake in how you depict me. I've been yelled at by generals and denounced by people who don't have any data when I have a shitload. It does no harm to me, but plenty to my patients. If the very warm reception of me in Cuba is portrayed as because I'm thought to be a sycophantic ally of Cuba, then the Cuban doctor's concern for the poor of Haiti would be lost. He went on in this way for a time. "If I say that Santiago de Las Vegas looks like a nice hacienda with a lot of labs and medical facilities, I'm a tool of the Cuban oppressors." He took up the cause of Dr. Perez. "Jorge is chief doctor of the Infectious Disease Institute, director of the sanatorium, chair of the National AIDS Program, visiting professor in many countries, on the board of directors by fiat, mine, of our program at Harvard. He has the ear of the president and the minister of health. He's at the pinnacle of power in Cuban medicine, and he lives like a lower middle class American, and he doesn't care. I have no generic liking for modest living. What I like is that Jorge believes this is right. He doesn't like social inequality. He believes in social justice medicine. That moves me. I hate to see that ridiculed. I hate it." There was vehemence in his voice, and I felt I was its object, as if I had already ridiculed Dr. Perez. I'm sure I felt offended, and maybe I felt hurt, though I'd hardly have admitted this at the moment. Farmer's emotional side lay close to the surface, and, as Ophelia said, his emotions were usually sympathetic. He cried openly over patients and the memories of patients. He greeted everyone in his wide circle with blushing elation. I was no less immune than most people to his warmth. Now he seemed to be withdrawing it, and I felt the chill. Was he saying he'd rather not travel with me anymore? Well then, the feeling was mutual. This guy kept the cybernetic equivalent of a bumper sticker on his computer, a screensaver that read, "Seek Justice." For me, at the moment, suddenly, the tone of this expressed all my problems with him. He began to talk about our next destination, Russia. He said it wasn't as important as Haiti. "Well, do you think I shouldn't come along with you?" I said. I tried to make my tone nonchalant. I'm not sure I succeeded. He looked surprised. "No, no, it's important." The scolding, if that's what it was, ended then. He said our conversation had just been the dismount of our time in Cuba. The term was one the farmer family had borrowed from Olympic gymnastics, which they'd watched together on TV on the boat, his buxom sister Peggy throwing out her chest in imitation of the stance the diminutive female athletes would take when they finished their routines. All the interns, residents, and fellows who worked with Farmer at the Brigham knew the term. "Okay, let's do the dismount," he would say, and they'd begin wrapping up discussion of a case. It was hard to stay angry at Farmer, especially then, as he sat there in his rumpled black suit, waiting out another airport delay in a barren little restaurant, worrying that his admiration for Cuba might be used against his cause and end up harming his patients in the Central Plateau. I wasn't sure we really had much of an argument over Cuba. Years of bad publicity heaped on the country's government had certainly colored my view of the place, but more than that, had made me wary of coming to conclusions. No question but that Cuba had pulled off something difficult and, in the view from Haiti, enviable, first-rate public health, equitably distributed, in spite of severely limited resources. I just wondered what price in political freedom its people paid for that achievement. But I understood that Farmer would frame the question differently and ask what price most people would be willing to pay for freedom from illness and premature death. For me, Cuba posed a rather abstract question. For Farmer, it represented hope, proof that a poor country could achieve good public health. "If I could turn Haiti into Cuba, I'd do it in a minute," he had said rather heatedly a while ago. I'd have agreed, if I hadn't felt that the heat was directed at me. We lingered in the restaurant. I asked him what his hopes for Haiti were. "I don't have any that are based on analysis or numbers or hard-headed interpretation of the best available data," he said. "But I have hopes for Haiti." These lay partly outside Haiti. Some people would say things will get so bad that Haitians will revolt. But you can't revolt when you're coughing out your lungs or starving. Someone's going to have to revolt on the Haitians' behalf, including people from the wealthy classes. He added, "But that would be regarded as a total joke by the left." He turned and gazed out the window. A large sign was affixed to an airplane hangar across the tarmac. It read, "Patria es humanidad," an internationalist assertion. The only real nation is humanity. "I think that's so lovely," Farmer said. "I don't know," I said. "It seems like a slogan to me." He looked away. "I guess you're right." I felt as though I'd punched him. Among a coward's weapons, cynicism is the nastiest of all. "No, it is lovely," I muttered, "if it's really meant." We got to Miami so late, and he had so much shopping to do, and so many emails had accumulated in his account, about 1,000 in all, at least 24 of which concerned patients and required immediate answers, that we almost missed our night flight to Paris. They closed the gate behind us, and Farmer declared our timing perfect. But the plane was full, and there was no room left for our briefcases. I felt as if I wedged myself into my seat, and Farmer's legs were longer than mine. For the last day and a half, I'd been suffering from diarrhea, not from the Cuban water, probably from too many mojitos. I had resolved not to tell Farmer, and remained determined not to, right up until I told him. We had taken off. He'd ingested a sleeping pill, a fast-acting benzodiazepine, and his eyelids were fluttering. They opened right up, however, when I made my complaint. He looked over at me, his face utterly serious. "From now on," he said, "I want a full report on all of your bowel movements." I felt greatly reassured. much better already, in fact, and the last remnants of my anger at Farmer seeped away. It still seemed to me that he took a stance all too conveniently impregnable. He embodied a preferential option for the poor. Therefore, any criticism of him amounted to an assault on the already downtrodden people he served. But I knew by now he wasn't simply posing. I felt something about him that I'd later framed to myself this way. He said patients came first, prisoners second, and students third. But this didn't leave out much of humanity. Every sick person seemed to be a potential patient of Farmer's, and every healthy person a potential student. In his mind, he was fighting all poverty, all the time, an endeavor full of difficulties and inevitable failures. For him, the reward was inward clarity, and the price, perpetual anger, or, at best, discomfort with the world. Not always on the surface, but always there. Sensing this, I'd begun to be relieved of the shallower discomforts I sometimes felt in his company, that I'd felt keenly back in the airport in Cuba. Farmer wasn't put on earth to make anyone feel comfortable, except for those lucky enough to be his patients. And for the moment, I had become one of those. Chapter 22. Farmer had loved Paris as a boy from Jenkins Creek on his college semester abroad, and he'd felt great anticipation when he'd taken his wife, Dee Dee, there. It was her first trip ever away from Haiti. "Wasn't this the loveliest city in the world?" he'd asked her. But the sights of its gorgeous parks and buildings had moved her differently. "Knowing that this splendor came from the suffering of my ancestors." Dee Dee was studying that subject now in Paris, in the archives of the French slave masters, in the detailed records they had kept of their commerce in West Africans. Since then, some of the city's charm had worn off for Farmer. The sleeping pills that he brought to get us through the flights have left my memories of our stop in Paris all wrapped up in gauze. I recall an early morning, Farmer gazing out the windows of the cab, re-entering the first world by staring at the cardboard box-like high-rises of the periphery, where, he said, many of the indigent of Paris had been relocated. As we entered the city proper, that great dove-colored Epicurean city, he murmured something about how much could be done in Haiti if only he could get his hands on the money that the first world spent on pet grooming. The cab led us off in the Marais district, a place of narrow streets and sidewalks, of bistros, diminutive hotels, and shops. The Farmer family residence was an apartment of three small rooms borrowed from one of his oldest friends from Duke. Dee Dee, tall and stately, met us at the door with an enormous smile. I remember thinking that Dee Dee probably was the most beautiful woman from Cannes, and I remember Farmer in his black suit, dancing with his daughter, holding her to his chest, swaying from side to side in a loopy, long-limbed waltz. And the little girl's dark eyes, which her face hadn't yet grown into, fixed in serious rapture on some invisible object on the ceiling. Later, Farmer sat on the sofa and watched Catherine play with her stuffed animals. Dee Dee called to him from the kitchen. "When did he leave for Moscow?" "Tomorrow morning," Farmer said. From the kitchen came the sound of something dropping and a deep-throated exclamation. I looked over at Farmer. He was clasping his knees with his elbows and covering his mouth with both hands. I remember thinking, despite my enveloping haze, I'd remember this. It was the first time I'd seen him at a loss for words or action. Ironic, I suppose, that just when his organization's endeavors had ceased to be global in theory and had become global in fact, a child had entered his life. Lately, he received a fair amount of criticism from friends for not spending more time with his family, and there were some who, when they spoke about this matter out of his earshot, seemed oddly animated. Their voices would rise, or they would smile conspiratorially. "Can you imagine what it's like being married to him?" I wonder if this was a species of moral envy. Jim Kim said, "Paul has a gift for making people feel guilty." Farmer counseled others to take vacations while taking none himself. He didn't disapprove of others having luxuries, so long as they gave something to the causes of the poor. He demanded a great deal from protégés and colleagues, and he always forgave them when they didn't measure up. And so I think it was a relief for some to find what looked like a chink in his moral armor. In Haiti, we'd had a conversation about his daughter. A month after she was born, a woman had come to Zalmi La Santé suffering from eclampsia. It is a disease of pregnancy, of mysterious origin, found preponderantly among poor women. It leads to protein in the urine, hypertension, seizures, and sometimes death for both mother and child. The treatment is magnesium sulfate and delivery of the child. The clinic was very busy. Farmer was rushing around trying to get the treatment started. He was saying to the staff, "Come on, get off your butts. Get an IV in. I want to induce her now." The baby was alive. He could hear the heartbeat. He remembered, "The mother was seizing. I said, 'Hurry!'" Everything was going okay. Then the baby was born. And it was dead. A full-term, beautiful baby, and I started to weep. I had to excuse myself and go outside. I wondered, what's going on? Then I realized I was crying because of Catherine. He had imagined her in the place of the stillborn child. "So, you love your own child more than these kids," he said to himself. He went on, "I thought I was the king of empathy for these poor kids, but if I was the king of empathy, why this big shift because of my daughter? It was a failure of empathy, the inability to love other children as much as yours. The thing is, everybody understands that, encourages that, praises you for it. But the hard thing is the other." I thought about this for a while, attempting to frame my question delicately. Finally, I just tried to disassociate myself from it. Some people would say, "Where do you get off thinking you're different from everyone and can love the children of others as much as your own? What would you say to that?" "Look," he replied, "all the great religious traditions of the world say, 'Love thy neighbor as thyself.' My answer is, I'm sorry, I can't. But I'm gonna keep on trying, comma." I imagine that many people would like to construct a life like Farmer's, to wake up knowing what they ought to do and feeling that they were doing it. But I can't think that many would willingly take on the difficulties, giving up their comforts and time with family. It wasn't as if this stopover in Paris represented all there was to his domestic life. He and Didi and Catherine spent the summers together in Cange, and no doubt those periods would lengthen once Didi finished her studies. But his days and nights looked hard, and in some ways lonesome. He was carrying a pair of photographs on this light month for travel. One was of Catherine, and at each stop he'd show it off to friends like any proud parent. But then sometimes he'd show the other, a photo of a Haitian child about the same age, except in the throes of kwashiorkor. At first, this seemed perverse to me, but the other, starving child, wasn't an abstraction, like the pictures of starving children on TV. She was Farmer's patient, and I think in his mind she stood for all the others, including tuberculosis prisoners in Russia, for whom he was leaving his daughter tomorrow on the morning flight to Moscow. I don't think anyone who knew how much Farmer craved connections among all parts of his life could have looked at him at that moment on the couch in Paris, all folded up as if trying to hide, and not felt some sympathy for his predicament. The moment passed. Farmer was stopping in Paris mainly for Catherine's second birthday party. The event was a success, and Catherine clapped her hands at her present, a mechanical bird on a wire that flew around the small living room. He'd bought it in the Miami airport. It was one of the reasons we'd almost missed the plane to Paris. Among the guests, there were a couple of members of the French family for whom Farmer had worked as an au pair almost 20 years ago, during his student year abroad. These days, they did some fundraising for PIH. There were also Haitian friends at the party, in France long enough that they no longer passed what Farmer called the fat test. That is, they looked well-fed. But Haiti was almost all they talked about. There was a family friend from Burkina Faso who told me he was homesick, and I was reminded of something Farmer had said, that PIH headquarters wasn't Boston or even Haiti, but wherever PIHers happened to be. He had built a web of acquaintance as large as any major politician's. The difference was that not many people in his web remained mere acquaintances for long, and not many would have found it easy simply to slip away, even if they wanted to. For Farmer, the worst kind of exile wouldn't be geographical. It would be something like excommunication. Before he went to bed, he phoned his mother in Florida to ask her to give him a wake-up call at 7 o'clock a.m. here in Paris. Didi shook her head. "We have an alarm clock," she said to me, but she was smiling. I counted time zones. His mother would have to be up at 1 a.m. to make the call. I wondered if she minded, but she told me some months later, "I just think it's so cool that at 40 he still does that. I'd miss it if he didn't." We got to the airport early for once and went to a cafe for breakfast. "Okay," Farmer said, when we found a table. "Time to get to work." He pulled out his most recent boîte list. Only about 2/3 of the little boxes had been checked. "This is shameful." He stared at the sheets of paper. "All these boîtes were supposed to be done before we left Cuba." Among them was a dual boîte, one that consisted of two chores. If he completed either, he'd get to check the box. The dual boîte commanded him either to buy new underwear or to finish a letter. I didn't get the underwear, so... This was a letter he had started during a hike we'd taken back in Haiti. He pulled the unfinished page from his briefcase. It had a grease stain on it, from some article of the fifth food group he'd eaten on the hike. "It seems fitting to write you as I sit in the middle of the Haitian countryside," the letter began. He bent over it, writing on. "Is this boîte transfer or boîte cheating?" I asked. "Depends on whether or not you have an H of G for the endeavor," he said, without looking up. An H of G was short for a hermeneutic of generosity, which he had defined once for me in an email. "I have a hermeneutic of generosity for you because I know you're a good guy. Therefore, I will interpret what you say and do in a favorable light. Seems like I'm the one who should hope for as much from you." I have counted scores of terms like that one in his lexicon, which was also the lexicon of PIH. Jim and Ophelia had invented some, and some came from the Brigham, but most were Farmer's, or his family's. One time his brother Jeff, the wrestler, sent him a card in which he misspelled the word Haitians. He spelled it H-A-T-I-A-N-S. So in PIH lingo, Haitians were Hattians, or simply Hats, and their country was Hatland. The French were Franches, their tongue, Franches language, and Russians were Ruskies. A Chatterjee was a person of East Indian descent. There were a few in PIH, who talked a lot. Farmer referred to himself as white trash. He had an old photo to prove it, his extended family at a picnic around a couch outdoors. The man who railed about the plight of impoverished women everywhere would, in private, poking fun, employ terms like chicks. "I don't care about any of that stuff," he told me once. "Just the one thing." Impolite terms, used intramurally, were meant as philosophical rebukes to the misplaced preoccupations of those who believed in identity politics, in the idea that all members of an oppressed minority were equally oppressed, which all too conveniently obscured the fact that there were real differences in the shaftedness, also sometimes called the degrees of hosedness, that people of the same race or gender suffered. "All suffering isn't equal," was an article of the PIH faith, generated in reaction to the many times when they had tried to raise money and instead had been offered lectures about the universality of suffering, or simply lines like, "The rich have problems too." Farmer once taught a course at Harvard called Varieties of Human Suffering. When people get around Paul, they start talking like Paul, his old friend from medical school, the writer Ethan Kanan, said. He's such a word gymnast. There was an obvious utility in the brevity of terms like H of G for a mind moving fast and for people trying to keep up. When, for instance, TBMI, Transnational Bureaucrats Managing Inequality, produced clever arguments, also known as well-formed stool, against treating MDR or AIDS, one could simply say, "Love ID," and be completely understood. Everyone in PIH knew that DQ stood for Drama Queen, and a DQ proposal meant an emotional appeal. We could use a DQ quote here, and a generic inequality of outcomes over here, I once heard Farmer say to a young assistant working with him on a speech. Geek Flowers was the completed research that PIHers presented to Farmer or Kim, and Skull Butt was short for scholarly buttressing, which meant that every statement of fact Farmer made in a paper had to be verified as coming from some authoritative source. He's neurotic about having it all perfect, said a medical student who did a lot of Skull Butt for Farmer. Not because he's anal, but because when you're doing these things for the poor, amidst arguments that it's not cost-effective to treat them, you have to be perfect, or you'll be picked apart. Lugar was luggage. Kutums meant customs. To commit a 7-3 was to use 7 words where 3 would do. And a 99-100 was quitting on a nearly completed job. Nothing pisses me off like a 99-100, Farmer would say. PIHers often said thank you to people who had done something for a third party, for anyone who belonged to the multitudinous group known variously as the indigent sick, the shafted, and the poor, the last being the term of choice in PIH because, as Farmer would say, it was the term that most Haitians used to describe themselves. You could hang around the inner circle of PIH for a long time without understanding what the rules were and feeling excluded, and the more left out you felt, the more you suspected you were being told you weren't as good as they were, even as you suspected that your irritation proved it. To me, the inner circle of PIH seemed like a club or even like a family, which was deeply opposed to the concept of insiders and outsiders, and yet equipped with its own special bylaws and language. Say that to Farmer, and he'd reply, "If so, it's surely the most inclusive damn club in the world, being full of people with AIDS, WLs galore, tons of students, church ladies, lots of patients. And it's a club that grows and never shrinks." And Farmer had a way of creating a club that consisted just of him and you. Back in Haiti, he had established a piece of private language for our month of travel. Discussing malaria with me, he'd explained there were 4 types, only one of which, falciparum, was often fatal. "So which one do you suppose Haiti has?" he asked. Then he added, "But it's not drug-resistant the way it is in Africa." He smiled, and then, adapting his favorite line from the movie Caddyshack, he said, "So we got that going for us." Then he pointed at me, and I soon learned this meant I was supposed to utter the next line in the movie. "Which is nice." After I got the hang of this call and response, I enjoyed it, and I must confess I felt a certain pleasure now at the airport cafe in knowing what he meant by an H of G. He went on writing his letter. I looked around. The airport Charles de Gaulle has an angular steel and glass simplicity, which struck me just then as frighteningly complex, which made me feel projected into a future I didn't understand. I thought of its duty-free shop, where one could buy first-class pâté, confit d'oie, Grand Cru wines. "You started that letter on a hike in rural Haiti," I mused aloud, thinking now of those arid highlands, of medieval peasant huts, donkey ambulances. It seems like another world. Farmer looked up, smiling, and in a chirpy-sounding voice he said, "But that feeling has the disadvantage of being," he paused a beat, "wrong." "Well," I retorted, "it depends on how you look at it." "No, it doesn't," he replied in a very pleasant voice. "The polite thing to say would be, you're right, it's a parallel universe. There really is no relation between the massive accumulation of wealth in one part of the world and abject misery in another." He looked at me. He'd made me laugh. "You know I'm being funny about something serious," he said. One time I listened to Farmer give a talk on HIV to a class at the Harvard School of Public Health, and in the midst of reciting data, he mentioned the Haitian phrase, "looking for life, destroying life." Then he explained, "It's an expression Haitians use if a poor woman selling mangoes falls off a truck and dies." I felt as if, for that moment, I could see a little way into his mind. It seemed like a place of hyper-connectivity. At moments like that, I thought that what he wanted was to erase both time and geography, connecting all parts of his life and tying them instrumentally to a world in which he saw intimate, inescapable connections between the gleaming corporate offices of Paris and New York and a legless man lying on the mud floor of a hut in the remotest part of remote Haiti. Of all the world's errors, he seemed to feel, the most fundamental was the erasing of people, the hiding away of suffering. My big struggle is how people cannot care, erase, not remember. I had wondered if there was room in his philosophy for anyone but the world's poor and people who campaigned on behalf of the poor. One day on an airplane, he confided to me that he thought of all our fellow passengers as patients. An attendant's voice had said over the intercom, "Is there a doctor on board?" He'd gotten up at once and ministered to a middle-aged, evidently middle-class American man who, as it turned out, wasn't having a heart attack. Back in his seat afterward, Farmer said this happened to him about once in every 18 flights. I had the impression that he wouldn't have minded if it happened every flight. Embracing a continuity and interconnectedness that excluded no one seemed like another of Farmer's peculiar liberties. It came with a lot of burdens, of course, but it also freed him from the efforts that many people make to find refuge and distinction from their pasts and from the mass of their fellow human beings. This book is continued on cassette 6.